For three decades now, Glenn Emery has been one of the best-known foreigners in Prague. The charismatic Canadian was a pioneering bar and club operator in the city back in the Wild East days of the 1990s, and he's still running pubs here today. Unsurprisingly, perhaps, Emery has accumulated lots of amazing stories over the years, tales which he has collected in an as-yet unpublished memoir. You spent some years in the 80s living in Slovakia because your dad was working there.
Yeah.
What was that like?
Living in Slovakia in 1979, 1980, it was very, very strange, especially for, you know, for us. We were kids, right? My sister and I. She was 15, I was 14 when we moved there. So it was an incredible culture shock. Like, out of this world, you couldn't really imagine, you know, coming from, you know, suburban Canada to deepest, darkest communism in the middle of a small town in the mountains of Slovakia. So yeah, it was very, very strange. Very strange. You know, the good things, the bad things, everything was completely...
Also, I guess for the locals, you must have been like somebody from another planet.
Yeah, it was also a big shocker for the locals, because there were the engineers there, their wives, their families, and some of the engineers were in their 60s, even 70s, some of the older guys. Some of them were in their 20s, you know, and so there was single, you know, young people. Then there was the children of the families. There was 300 Canadians there altogether. So there was about, I think, about 50 engineers, wives. Well, some of the engineers were women. So it was the engineers, their families, their spouses, their children. And then there was, in this town of, at the time, there was 10,000 people, maybe 12, 13,000 people, called Ružomberok. So there was the 300 Canadians. Then there was 1,000 Yugoslavs who were the subcontractors. They were from all over Yugoslavia, and they were all single guys, pretty much all single guys. So you can imagine it was completely haywire. Plus there was Cubans in town. There was about 50 Cubans who worked at there was a big factory making textiles. So there was the Cubans. Then there was some Vietnamese, of course. So yeah, all of a sudden you could just imagine in sort of backwater, mountain, small town, communist Czechoslovakia, all of a sudden it was very cosmopolitan.
You came to Prague a few months after the end of communism in April 1990. What were your initial impressions when you arrived here?
I always say that it was like being in a cartoon that you drew yourself. It was just complete madness. Nothing made any sense. You know, when I first got here, right after the revolution, and I think I got here in April of 1990, there was no police around. There was, you know, people on Moose Deck, you know, with a couple crates of beer on either side and a plank in between, selling porno magazines and apples, you know, and everything in between, and bottles of booze and cigarettes and T-shirts and baseball caps. And this was going on night and day. There was gangs of thieves roaming around and pickpocketing.
What do you mean there was no police, though?
Well, the police had kind of disappeared after the revolution. You didn't see any. Very seldom did you see police, especially on the streets. So you would always have the, you know, the lollipop guys, the guys who would, you know, stand on the side of the road and indiscriminately pull over cars. So they were still around. But generally, you didn't really see police around. They kind of went underground for a little while. They came back. They had a resurgence. But when I first got here, yeah, you didn't see many cops around.
Later, of course, you became known for operating bars. But what were the first things that you did when you arrived here?
Well, when I first got here, I was here for the summer of 1990. So I got here like in April, May, June, July. I went back in August. So I was here for a few months in 1990. Then I went home back to university. And when I finished, I came back. So I got back here in 1991. And when I was here in 1990, I met some other Canadian guys and we decided that we would try to do some business together. And the first thing we did was we tried to do some T-shirts, selling tourist T-shirts. We did all that, you know, stuff you do when you're young. Then we opened actually Laundry Kings up in Davidsey. We opened the first coin-operated laundromat.
That was you?
Yeah.
I remember that place.
Grady and I, pretty much. And there was two other Canadian guys involved, but it was mostly Grady and I that organized and put the whole thing together. Yeah, then I had a falling out with my Canadian partners, and I basically was left by myself, and that's when I decided that I would try to open a bar. That was in 1990, end of 91. So in 92, I think I signed the lease on the space in Malastrana in, I think, March or April of that year.
You're talking now about Joe's Bar, which, yeah, I guess is maybe one of the most famous expat bars ever in Prague. And you say you were the first foreigner to legally own a bar here. What are your strongest memories of the early days of Joe's Bar?
The strongest memories of well, I mean, it was pretty crazy. Everybody was young and footloose and fancy free, or whatever the expression is. I guess the general impression was that it was a really crazy time. You know, it was kind of like a new country. It was very dynamic. Things were changing. It was wild. It was radical. It was very anarchic. And the people that came through at the time were very adventurous sorts. Not like because back in the day there was no convertible currency. You basically were changing money on the streets and back alleys. There was no American Express. Traveler checks were not accepted. It was just this, you know, there was no McDonald's. There was no, you know, none of the trustafarians could come because there was no way that their daddy could send them money. And if you did get money sent, it would disappear into the, you know, backwaters of the check banks for weeks on end, where there, you know, who knows where it went. And you'd have to go in there ultimately and you know, fight with them to get your money out. So things were pretty crazy back then. It was a very different sort of kind of people that were coming through Prague, as far as the sort of adventurers and travelers that were coming through. You know, so there was a lot of really wild and wonderful and strange and curious people that were around in the early days till about 95, 96, even later, maybe 97. Like I said, you know, the impressions of the early days, it was really wild, really anarchic and dynamic, exciting. And everybody was in their 20s, so, you know, so the way you look at life is completely different.
Obecný dům is one of the grandest buildings in Prague, but still you and your business partner, John Bruce Shoemaker, somehow took over half of it and were running restaurants and cafes and stuff. How did that ever happen?
John Bruce, for all of his faults, he got a lot of stuff done, and he had somehow been sniffing around Obecný dům. He'd been looking at it somehow, and he knew that there was a couple guys, a couple Czech guys that were running the whole thing, and they were just really strange individuals. And somehow JB got in touch with the management of the building, maybe about a different space in the building, and then got talking with the guy who was in charge of renting the spaces. And he said, by the way, those guys are out because they haven't paid rent for half a year or whatever. And da, 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 da. And so JB said, well, is it possible? Maybe I could take over the spaces. And he said, yes, it's possible. And then what's the deal? And this was the deal. And it was only a short-term thing, like I think a one-year contract, because they were going to shut the Obecný dům for reconstruction. Then JB came to me because he didn't have anything legal at the time. And I had a limited company. I had all the paperwork. I had the licenses for running bars and restaurants, and for selling, you know, alcohol and food, etc. So he came to me, and he also needed a lot of money. And I knew some investors who were hanging around my place. And they would always say to me, listen, you know, Glenn, if you know of anything interesting that's happening, give us a call. So I gave this guy a call, and we showed him the project. And he came up with the original, you know, down payment, because we had to put the deposit down on the rents. And we also had to clean up the place and buy stock, etc., blah, blah. Basically, JB did the groundwork for getting a hold of the space, and then he came to me and the two of us got it together somehow.
And did you ever walk in there in the morning and look around at this space?
Every day.
And think, how the hell did I become the boss of all of this?
Every day. Every day. Every minute of every day. I would sit there and look around and go, what the hell's going on here? I really just couldn't believe it. Yeah, we had that Café Nouveau. It was this spectacular place. And downstairs, the Repre Club, which was this ginormous, you know, I mean, it was just ridiculous, really ridiculous. You know, like original, so running a nightclub, you could imagine a nightclub with a discotheque and a DJ on big scaffolding platform and a 15, 12, 13-meter long bar, people running around half naked, drunk, dance floor, punk bands, yet a few meters above their heads were original Art Nouveau crystal chandeliers hanging off the ceiling, you know, and Art Nouveau murals on the walls, and all the frescoes and the plaster work was all original Obecný dům municipal house. And two floors above us was the whole Mucha, Alphonse Mucha Museum. And downstairs we had this complete bonanza going on. And we had Nigerian, you know, 7 foot tall Nigerian bouncers. And you'd walk in and people were getting thrown out on their heads. And it was just, it was surreal. It was like walking into the bar in Star Wars, you know.
You had several bars, Glenn, including the famous Thirsty Dog in Obecný dům. Of all the places that you had, is there anyone you look back on with particular fondness?
Well, all of them for different reasons, yeah. I would probably rate them more for the troubles they made me than the good times, because all of them were full of good times all the time. But each one, what's the quote from, is it Tolstoy? Anna Karenina, that all happy families are very alike, but every unhappy family is different in its own way. And the bars were like that with respect to the good times were all very similar. You know, a lot of people drinking and having a great time and interesting people and great conversation and blah, blah, blah. But each one of those bars created different problems for me in very different ways.
You were in your late 20s at the time. How did banks and building owners and people like that respond when this young guy comes in, I guess not wearing a suit or whatever, saying you want to do business?
I think you had good looks get you there, but the brains keep you there, kind of thing. And so coming in from the West, even though I was young, gave me a certain amount of credence just because, you know, I was from the West. And some people would take it as a good thing. Some people, like I said, you know, had been taught their whole lives that we were the enemy. That sort of attitude usually came from the city officials that I had to deal with, like from the hygiene department and the city hall, et cetera, because back in those days, the people that got to any sort of position were apparatchiks. So they weren't necessarily in the position, their job positions, because of any inherent skills or capabilities, but it was because they towed the party line. So they were classic apparatchiks, you know, the kind of people that Trump hires, right? Incompetent people, but they're loyal to the cause. So I would usually not have so much problems with the landlords of places. And also because, you know, I just come out of engineering school. And so when you go into these negotiations, I was speaking very, very logically and in a straight line, you know. So, yeah, I never had too many problems with the landlords. It was usually people around the landlords, you know, like other family members who were, you know, there's always some conspiracy and where's all the money and da, da, da. And it was between them, but somehow you would get involved for whatever. Like I said, every place something different was going on, you know, so.
Earlier, we spoke a little bit about John Bruce Shoemaker, who is a name that will be familiar to anybody who was in Prague in the 90s, any
Yep.
expats. He was a larger-than-life character. He ran bars. You knew him well. What kind of stuff would you guys get up to?
Well, he was a really crazy, wild and crazy guy. He was a bit of a culty personality. It's so funny because I mentioned Trump before. I never liked Trump. I knew him from back in the 80s when you used to see him on TV with Ivana Trump and, you know, his casinos, and he was always in the press. But when he became president and the way he spoke, and so many times I would look at him and go, that's exactly what John Bruce would have said, you know, in these situations. And it's this sort of, you know, gaslighting and the, you know, this whole kind of con man persona. You know, some people are just naturally like that. Some people work on it. To John Bruce, it was just sort of a natural way of dealing with life. But him and I and others, you know, there was a whole bunch of us that used to hang around together, got into all sorts of really wild and crazy situations. And John Bruce was, you know, always one of the prime movers in all of these. He would get up to all sorts of crazy things. Yeah, he was a real wild individual. And it was funny because he came from a really good family, quite a wealthy background. He went to the University of Oregon. He was an athlete. You know, he was a middle distance runner, quite a good one, from Eugene, Oregon, which is the University of Oregon or Oregon University. It's quite a famous school, especially for athletics. And so he came out of that, and he's very well educated. You know, he wrote a book that actually got turned into a film. He worked as a journalist for many years. He was a very intellectual guy, incredibly interesting. One of the greatest guys ever to sit down and have drinks with or to get drunk with, because he was a great storyteller. He was very well versed in any subject or most subjects, because he's a journalist. Journalists are always like yourself. Journalists are always great people to sit and have drinks with or to talk with, because they know a lot of things about a lot of different subjects. So, and JB was like that, but he was also this incredible storyteller. And, you know, he would gesticulate and be spitting and sweating and rolling around, and everybody would be falling over laughing their heads off. It was really fun to hang out with him. But you had to watch out, because he was a bit of a wolf in sheep's clothing.
When I was preparing for this interview, you very kindly let me read your as yet unpublished memoir, which is full of brilliant stories. One of them that I didn't know about was that you were involved in the squatting of Cafe Slavia in 1993, which I remember going there when it was occupied by people who shouldn't have been there. Tell us that story, please.
At the time, Marek Gregor had started working for us, doing some different events in Repper Club and in the cafe. promoting different things, not just bands. And we were sitting down, and it was around the end of October, and somebody floated the fact that November 17th, the anniversary of the revolution, was coming up, and we were trying to, we thought, well, we should do something for the anniversary. And at the time, the Slavia was a big, it was in the press all the time, because there was the Parnas next door, was the Parnas and the Cafe Slavia had been rented by the dean of FAMU, I think. FAMU owns that building. And the dean had rented it out to this company called HN Gorin that was run by a Boston developer. And the guy who was the Yednatel, or the general director, was a Czech-American guy. And he didn't like what had happened, because basically they were supposed to reconstruct or put so many millions of crowns into reconstructing the whole building. And as a reward, they were supposed to get their hands on Slavia and Parnas. And what these guys did is they didn't put any money into the building. They subrent Parnas out to this Indian restaurateur. And he just started running Parnas as a high-end restaurant, paying these guys a lot of rent. And they'd shut down Cafe Slavia and turn it into basically a storage room. And it was just full of rats and you know, rotten apples and rotten meat and, you know, whatever. And everybody was pissed off, because we used to hang out there all the time. It was a fantastic cafe. And it was in the press all the time. And this company, HN Gorin, was trying to hide from the whole thing. And then ultimately, we started talking about it, and at the same time, the daughter of this managing director, I won't say any names, she's no longer with us, rest in peace, but she came to me because she was a regular at my bar, and she said, hey, blah, 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 my dad is the guy who's the general director of this company that's supposed to have the Slavia, and he's really pissed off with what's going on, and he wants to talk to you. And so we went and had a meeting with him, and we said, well, that's funny you say that, because we were thinking of doing something. And this could be the perfect storm. And so basically we decided that we were going to go down and take over the Slavia, clean it up, and run it. And that's what we did. And basically the cops were trying to figure out if there was any improprieties other than us breaking down the door.
I was going to say, how did you get in?
We tried to drill out the lock, but the guy who showed up at 5 o'clock that morning was drunk, and his cordless drill ran out of batteries. So we just had a few bouncers with it. We just pushed the door open, and then we changed the lock for me. Well, I forget. We were in there for about 2 weeks. And finally, the cops at one point, the cops were about, and I was kind of talking all the time with the cops and the officials, and the cops were just about to arrest me. And I turned, and the guy, this managing director guy, the Czech-American guy, I said, listen, mate, you better do something here, or I'm going to end up in jail. And that's when he finally stood forward and said, listen, I'm the guy on the paperwork. And he showed the paperwork, and then the cops pissed off. And then it sort of went to a different level. And at that point, I just wanted out of there. I didn't want anything more to do with it, because we were losing a bunch of money on it. And of course, it got co-opted by all the Czechs and Mark Gregor and blah, blah, blah. They all co-opted the whole project. All this was going on. They never mentioned myself nor John Bruce, even though we were the ones who paid for the whole action, who organized the whole thing and funded the whole action. And it was all over the Czech press. It was in the front page of the New York Times, and only on the front page of the New York Times did they mention John Bruce and I. But in the Czech press, they'd never mentioned us ever, you know. And so I was getting all pissed off with it. I was like, you know what? I've had enough of this. And then it sort of went to another level, and however it turned out. I after that, I didn't really care. It was sort of out of our hands.
One thing that I found striking reading your book was the amount of violence in the pages. For example, you talk about your dad was visiting, you had drinks with some friend, and a few days later he was shot dead in the street.
Mm-hmm.
Other people you knew were killed. Did you find yourself in a lot of hairy situations?
Yeah, sure. But I found myself in a lot of hairy situations, you know, all through my life, you know, back in Canada and up in the gold fields, and I've been, you know, in a lot of places.
So was that kind of background good preparation for dealing with mafia and Prague and stuff like
that?
Yeah,
I mean, I never really had to deal with mafia so much. I mean, I knew mafia guys. I knew quite a few, but they never bothered me. You know, like the Serbians would go and coerce, you know, or blackmail other Yugoslavs on Yugoslavs, Russians on Russians, but they would never come after some Canadian guy, you know, or American guy. You know, they'd say, what, you know?
Well, so that's one thing it's easy to forget, actually, is how much of a Yugoslav influence there was in Prague in those days.
Yeah, I mean, when I first came to Prague, all my best mates were Yugoslavs, all of them. And I'll say something about that, too, because that's always something very interesting that I learned that I'd never ever run into anywhere before, was when I came to Prague, you would run into Yugoslavs, you become a friend with one Yugoslav, And unlike, as I live in the UK, I lived in the United States, lived in Germany, lived in Holland, all different places in Canada. When you make a friend and they introduce you to their friends will make their own judgment about you. They won't, just by virtue of you being their friend's friend, be a friend of yours too. With the Yugoslavs, it's completely different. You make friends with one, and all of a sudden, all of their best friends are best friends with you. And there's no, you know, there's no, there's, it's unconditional. So I ran into a lot of Yugoslavs in the early days because there were so many of them here. This is before the war, who were here studying at FAMU. Most of, not all of them, but most of them were at FAMU, you know, studying film. Then there was a lot of other Yugoslavs, ex-Yugoslavs, so they're from Serbia, Croatia, wherever, Slovenia, Macedonia. Other ones were here at university, you know, at Cheve Ute, at the technical college or university, or at Charles University. And some were here just living here just to get away from Yugoslavia. So when we go out at night, there was all these students we would hang out with. And they were like, you know, because they always said that, you know, Tito had one leg in the east and one leg in the west. And so when I first got here, it was quite difficult to get along with the local, you know, people. But the Yugoslavs were like, you know, talking to the guy next door. So we got along really well. And they, for the first 2-3 years, all my closest friends were Yugoslavians.
One thing you write also in the memoir, and I quote, "I have conflicts with Czechs on almost a daily basis."
Yeah.
Why is that, Glenn?
Well, I mean, it's not so much anymore. But back in those days, yeah, it was, yeah, sure, absolutely. Anybody that's lived here for a long time knows that deeply embedded in the Czech psyche is this love of discordance. If they can throw a clanger in your works, if they can any way, shape, or form, they get off on this somehow. It's part of the soul of the people. And coming from a country where it's in, you know, inherently the other way around, you have conflict. So it's just, you know, there's no way around it. So if you're trying to make things work and you're always running into people who are trying to throw a clanger into that, you're gonna have conflict. Even just walking down the road. I don't know if you remember, I don't know how long you were here. You could be walking down the road and there'd only be 10 other people on the street and one of them would bump into you. One of them would bump into you. And you're like, what the hell just happened? You know, if you were looking up at a building, because, you know, the tops of the buildings where all the nice stuff is, somebody would bump into you. And it's like, what the hell? There's only 5 people on this whole street.
Is it some different concept of personal space or something? Maybe?
Well, there's that, but it's also this whole thing about being discordant. You know, whatever they can do to, you know, screw with you, make things difficult, you know, they'll do it. It's not so bad anymore, but it still happens.
Almost 30 years later, you're still running bars in Prague. But I have to ask you, how do you, in general, view the way that Prague has changed over the last 30 years?
When I first got here, people were out running around crazy all night, going out doing all-nighters and blah, blah, blah. And there was not a worry in the world. And the revolution just happened. And the world was their oyster. But then all of a sudden, bank loans came out, car loans, payment programs. Then the lifestyle magazines came out, the Cosmopolitan and the GQ and the magazines that taught the women how to spurn the men and taught the men how to dress and how to shave and how to act and how to behave. And all of these things collectively started to put fear in the eyes of the population and started forcing people to get out of bed in the mornings, you know, to go to work and so they can make the money so they can pay the debt, so they can go to work so they can pay the debt, so they can get the car and to keep up with the Joneses. And so this sort of rat race, you know, started to develop. And it developed really quickly. So there's that. And then, you know, of course, all the superficial things like seeing McDonald's and this bank and that bank and American Express and all the, you know, Cartier and, you know, all the high-end shops on Paziska Street and then the shopping malls and, you know, everybody's driving a flash car. I mean, I was just up in Denmark a few years ago on my motorcycle. I was like, nobody drives flash cars in Denmark. Everybody's driving like little Opals and, you know. And you come to Prague, and all of a sudden, it's just, you know, everybody's, you know, driving super Uber flash cars, you know. On the good side, I used to have to deal with the officialdom. And recently, I've had to deal with officialdom. And it's really, really nice. It's young people. They're friendly. They try to help you. It's like, it's really changed.
Yeah, it's
really,
like night and day. It's really the
total
changes.
Total night and day. I mean, I remember back in the day when I had to go to the foreigners' police, it was a nightmare. It was out of a Kafka horror film. I mean, it was so disgusting. And then the last time I had to deal with them, they like, come over here, you speak Czech, how is that possible? Come, and they brought me in.
Even have a little kind of nursery spot for kids,
yeah,
in the corner.
Nursery spot for kids. Yeah, last time I was shocked that everybody there was younger than me. They were super friendly, getting me a coffee, and, you know, I was in shock. And also, the service industry is much better. I mean, I remember what it used to be like. It was really, really horrible. And so now, you go to places usually and the staff are friendly. And of course, a lot of this is a product of the Czechs being big travelers as they are. And in the last 25 years, the young people have gone out and lived overseas and lived in other places and seen how things work in sort of a normal, normal. I mean, sort of Western civilization. They come back and they open their own places and they sort of set the bar. They set the pace and everything percolates from the top down. And so if the person who's running the place is trying to set the level to something that they'd seen in Australia, or in London, then you walk in as a customer and you feel that right away.
My final question is, I don't want to sound like one of those guys in the Monty Python sketch, when I was a lad and all that stuff. But obviously, when we were first living here, you were here a couple of years before me in the early 90s, Prague did feel like a kind of magical place. There was something in the air. Do you think it's still here somewhere?
Yes, I do. Prague has always been a very magical place. It was when I got here and I was in my 20s and you're young and everything, and you're much more romantic than I am now in my 50s. And of course, it was dirty and it wasn't painted. It wasn't all Disneylandish. So it was really magical. And you could walk at night straight into the castle and go and sit with a bottle of wine in the Golden Alley with a candle and a few friends and sit there till the sun comes up. Today you can't get anywhere near you'd end up in jail. And so there was really magical. You could end up in all these weird places, But Prague is still a very, very incredibly magical place. Incredibly magical. You walk around at night, and a bit of fog and nobody around. It's an incredible town. It's just a magical, enchanting, enchanted town.
Glenn Emery is hoping to publish his book, Thirsty Dogs, The Left Skank of the 90s, in the coming months. So watch out for that title whenever it becomes available.